You cracked me up with your Saturday roll calls.
Yeah, like, I did one this morning. Yep, yeah. And they're like at 4 o'clock, so.
Yeah, and it's like I'll just have been waking up, and it was posted like 4 hours ago.
Yeah.
Sometimes I want to comment on them, but I'm like, I'm late to the party.
Yeah, I know. It's like if you can't say good morning, it's already like, hey, yeah. Dinner time. And
right. Sam Miranda, how the hell are you?
I'm great, man.
This is a long time coming. Like okay, so you came onto my radar. I don't even know if you remember this. You came onto my radar, maybe it was 2018. Sol Peligro opened up for Los Lobos at Ace of Spades.
Correct. Yes.
And I was still very new to Sacramento, so maybe it was before 2018.
It was 2018. Was it September 2018, okay. To be exact.
I was still getting familiarized with Sacramento.
Okay.
And I've seen, like any Mexican American our age, I've seen Los Lobos like 1,000 times.
Oh yeah.
And so I grabbed tickets and I was like, let's go check out the opening band. And all right. You guys fucking blew. Like, I was like, this is bigger than a local act opening up. There's got to be a history with this band.
Right.
You guys really reminded me a lot of, I grew up in Bakersfield. You guys really reminded me of my buddy Matt Munoz's band, Mento Buru.
Okay, I've heard of those guys.
Yeah.
I've heard of those guys. Yeah.
You guys both have distinct sounds, but very, I could see the punk, the Latin, all of that influence in there. So let's just get started with you, man. Did you grow up in Sacramento?
No.
Just
to break down the timeline, born in Los Angeles, lived in Whittier.
Okay.
And when I was, I think, 2 years old, we moved up north, up here, to this little town called Woodland.
I know Woodland.
It's out past the airport over here,
yeah,
okay?
Yeah,
and that's where I basically went to school, elementary school, middle school, graduated high school there. So that's where I was raised.
Okay.
Pretty much.
I love Woodland, and I joke around that, like, everyone from Sacramento, their grandma lives in Woodland.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, somebody's elders are there somehow. Yeah, and then since the late 90s, I've been in the Sacramento area, or out of the Woodland, because I lived down south for a little bit. You know, everybody's got to do that when they graduate or anything.
I gotta get out of this town.
You know what I mean? You got to do something with yourself in your early 20s before you actually settle down, I guess, if you want to say that. So, but for the majority of these last 20-some-odd years, I've been in Sacramento.
Okay, so Sacramento is home now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hometown is Woodland. Home is Sacramento.
So, I get it. And where was Sol Peligro born? Or where was the inclination to be a frontman born?
Well, to be a front man.
You're the lead singer.
Yeah.
That's the front man.
I'll be honest with you, man. It started when I was 7 years old.
Okay.
There was, you know, because my mom always played music around the house.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you grow up, you know, Mexican-American,
what's your mom playing?
Well, she was playing a lot of, a little bit of everything. So anything from Los Tigres del Norte, obviously Vicente Fernandez, you can't walk into a Mexican household and then not hear that or see any record, CD, cassette.
He's the Mexican Elvis.
Exactly. You know, and then Los Bukis. But then she also listened to a lot of English music. There was a lot of John Lennon, Beatles. And she also got me into the movies Saturday Night Fever in Greece.
Yes.
And so that's where I kind of like got the bug of wanting to perform. Because I'll tell you, man, the first time I saw John Travolta, you know, in the Saturday Night Fever, he walked into the club.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody is giving him high fives and daps, and then, you know, the scene where he has his brother, the ex priest or whatever. Uh-huh. Even, you know, he was like, "Wow, everybody parts the sea for you in here," you know. And he was like, "Yeah, we're the faces," you know. And I was just like, "Wow, this dude's got some energy to him." Uh-huh. And then you see him on Grease, and then he's, you know, singing and dancing.
Yeah,
it's like, "Wow, okay, I kind of like this," you know, and I just started, you know, playing those soundtrack records and dancing along. And then all of a sudden I hear a Mexican song on the radio once when we were driving. And there's this young kid, Pedrito Fernandez.
Oh, fuck.
And you know what song I'm going to probably bring up. And so, La de la Mochila Azul.
Pasa, chiquito, yeah.
La de la Mochila Azul. Yeah. And you know, then I find out he's exactly my age.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's like, you know, he was 7, 8 years old when he came out with that. I was like, oh wow. So my mom bought me the 45, and yeah, that's all I sang, man. And so that's what gave me the bug. And then fast forward, you know, just I just started enjoying any kind, you know, any kinds of music, because hanging out with kids in elementary school, not everybody was Mexican, you know, so I hung out with a lot of white kids.
Yeah.
So that's when I got into Van Halen.
Yes.
Quiet Riot.
Yes.
You know, metal, you know, in general, mm-hmm. rock and roll and stuff. And I was like, whoa, this is pretty badass, you know. And so, I mean, just being around all styles of music at home, at school, and just amongst other family members, man, that's basically where I just started to, like, I got to do something with this, you know. And I was thinking about this as a kid, man, yeah. and, you know, not so, thinking, you know.
So what was the first band? What was the first time that you saw somebody jamming and you're like, let me get up there? How did that happen?
This is funny. So in high school, obviously I got into hip hop.
Okay.
Okay, so that was another big influence.
So that's like 87, 88, 89?
Yeah, pretty much, man, because, you know, again, I'm over here.
I'm class of 89. What are you?
I'm class of 90.
Okay, cool. All right.
Okay, so we're the same.
Yeah, got it.
We're from the same ilk, you know, when it comes to that.
So Run DMC, the Beastie Boys.
Exactly. I was blown away when, you know, I was into rap because my cousins were playing Grandmaster Flash. So the message, I was like, ooh, this is funky.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden I hear Run DMC, they're rapping and they're doing rock,
mm-hmm.
two things that I enjoy a lot. Wow, blown away. And then here comes the Beastie Boys, then all of a sudden Cool J, Public Enemy, all of this kind of stuff. So I got the rapping bug, so I wrote some raps.
Oh, okay.
And so I started to rap, man.
Okay.
Yeah, that was my first kind of, like, you know, thing. Grab the microphone at a party and even in school and stuff. So it was, that's where I got it. You know, a lot of the times I had to write stuff down because I wasn't really a great freestyler, mm-hmm. you know, without repeating myself. So, so you know, it was great. You know, I got together with some friends of mine, started, you know, putting songs together. And then, you know, I just started to really feel like, well, you know what? I actually want to write a song, like, you know, mm-hmm. arrange it certain ways, and started to learn that on my own. And then we, started to really, like, you know, talk to each other, like, hey, you know, maybe we should put some together, you know. We released a cassette and with two friends of mine, and it was funny, though. It was like, it was a mix of singing and rapping, so it was like, you know, two Mexicans and a white kid.
What'd you guys call yourself?
We called ourselves Show and Tell.
Like Show and Tell?
Yeah, with the letter N.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, and then if we wanted to get tough, it was SNT. But yeah. And
was it the SNT crew?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, hey, New Kids on the Block had NKOTB. We were SNT. So it was cool, man. It was just, you know, one of those things where I was getting my feet wet to, you know, kind of like, you know, being in a studio, recording, putting songs together, releasing them on cassette.
That's fucking,
you know what
so
I mean?
You guys recorded it in a studio?
Yes, we did.
Wow.
Yeah, and we recorded it at a place called, I think it was called New World Studios.
Do you remember how much it cost to record?
I think it was, well, per hour, the studio time was like $20 an hour.
Uh-huh.
And to duplicate cassettes, I think we duplicated like 100. It was like, man, like $150.
Wow.
Tops.
In high school?
In high school, yeah.
Wow.
So we were, you know, we were doing it, and I had fun doing it. I mean, at the time, because again, I'm figuring myself out.
Yeah,
like, you know,
yeah.
And I was, hey, yeah, let's do that. I've always wanted to release music,
uh-huh.
you know, stuff that I wrote, you know. It was really like, wow. And then moved on from that group and created another group with a really close friend of mine, JT. We called ourselves the BRC. It's another rap group.
Okay, what was BRC?
BRC stood for the Brown Reality Coalition.
Coalition.
So I started to, you know, it was like my hard side, I guess, if you want to say it.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And really quick with that, it was like, okay, we need to find somebody that's going to help us put these beats together, you know, produce, help us, you know, do whatever. Called the studio, the same individual, the engineer, I should say, that helped us with the Show and Tell cassette. I called him, hey, looking for somebody to make some beats for me. Oh yeah, give this guy Kevin a call. Cool, gave him a call, and we met, and you know, he charged me a little something, and we started to put together some music. And then little did I know, it was Brother Lynch Hung.
Shut the fuck up.
Yeah, it was Kevin. That's his name, Kevin Mann.
So he's the one giving you the beats, or selling you the beats.
We had making our beats. He produced our cassette. He produced the BRC cassette.
What?
And this was at the time when he just...
So he's Sacramento. I thought he was Vallejo.
No, he's Sacramento.
He's Sacramento.
He's Sacramento. And so he helped us produce our cassette. We hung out a lot. And this was at the time when the X-Rated album had dropped, and he was getting ready to release 24 Deep. So it was around that time when he wasn't big yet, but you know, he was still, you know, who he was. And then we finished that, released it, you know, and to this day, there's collectors out there that still want that because he's on it.
You know what? Because we're the same age, there's a moment in music history that I think was very poignant to our generation. I'm going to ask you about it and see if you have a perspective on it.
Okay.
To me, the world changed and hip-hop was born. Well, it was already alive, but it was introduced to the world the night that Michael Jackson did the moonwalk on the Motown 25 year anniversary. Do you remember that moment, and do you remember how it changed everything?
I do remember the moment, but I didn't get to watch it live.
Okay,
because you know, we didn't have cable. Okay. You know what I mean? And then it was kind of like, you know, growing up in a household where there's only maybe three channels and then only one TV.
Right.
Parents had control of the TV and they were all watching their novelas. You know what I'm saying? And so I knew it was happening though. You know, what was it? The American Music Awards, or
was it something like that? I googled it recently because I was doing research for this book that I want to do.
Yeah.
And it was a Motown 25th anniversary.
Okay, that's what it was.
But the crazy thing about it is that it took place in a theater in Pasadena.
Okay.
And I thought that for sure it would have been like in Detroit or like New York at the Apollo, but no, it was at a theater in Pasadena.
And
it blew my mind.
You know what? And I'm actually not surprised though, because keep in mind, man, back then everything was happening in LA. All the studios, all the productions, everything was Los Angeles.
And I also wanted to ask you, what generation are you? I'm first generation American. How many generations has your family been in the States?
I think I'm probably third.
I was gonna guess you were third.
I'm third generation. Because my mom was born here in the States, Chicago to be exact.
And
so
your grandparents were here or Mexico?
Mexico.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So I'm third. I think I'm third.
Yeah. You're third. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. But that Michael Jackson thing though, I knew it hit hard with people, because the next day at school there was this kid, doing the moonwalk, and now you see all the kids in the playground doing the moonwalk. It's like, oh, you guys saw it, didn't you?
Yeah, the next day at school, it was everywhere on the play. Everyone was breakdancing.
Yeah,
everyone was
exactly
dancing, everyone, and it's been that way ever since.
Yeah, yeah, no. And then one of my friends was like, "Oh, it's all right, Sammy, come over. My mom videotaped it or got it recorded." You know what I mean? Because you could plug in the VCR and record whatever you wanted at that time and stuff. So yeah, no.
Okay, I just wanted to ask you about that. Okay, so your second group. Right, is the group produced by Brother Lin Chang? That's crazy.
Yeah.
And then how long did that last? And when did Soul Peligro finally form? And was that a long process of like, I know a guy, he knows a guy? What? How did that come about?
Yeah, it was kind of like, you know, I mean, there was a big gap between the early '90s and then 2005 when Peligro, you know, was born. Because that next month, to be exact, it's our 19th anniversary.
Wow.
So we would have been together. Yeah, we'll be together for 19 years.
19 years.
Yeah, and how that all happened is like, you know, I'm not going to take too much time with this. Is like right around the BRC, we just stopped doing music, and then I started hanging out with guys that play real instruments. You know, actual, you know, drums, guitars, and bass. And so I started hanging out with these guys. They were called Fibes Infernal Machine. So they did like, you know, some alternative rock, and I was just blown away. You know, and they were coworkers.
This is what, like
early '90s.
Okay.
And so I started hanging out with these guys, because these guys were coworkers of mine. They're saying, "Hey, come out and watch us play. We're playing the Cattle Club. And then since you and your boy rap, get up on stage and rap with us."
Okay.
With live instruments. I was like, "Yes," you know, and got on stage with them. And then little did I know, on the lineup it was Fibes Infernal Machine, this local group that is no longer around. They're called Funky Blue Velvet, and the Deftones. And so this was like, you know, like, I'm like, wow, you know, here's Chino and Chi and Abe from the Deftones. We're all hanging out, you know, and there's this little side spot or whatever. We're all, you know, drinking beers.
Had the Deftones broke by then, or were they still just a local group?
They were still local. They were just still local, you know, and they were still just, they sounded badass, of course. But so did a couple of shows with those guys. And then, you know, people disbanded, you know, I left finally, you know, Woodland to come to Sacramento, caught a job over at Tower Records headquarters. And that's where I caught the bug of rock en español.
Oh, shit.
I'm a late bloomer when it comes to
So am I.
It's been around since the 80s, right? But then I wasn't privy to it until like 98.
So who grabbed you back then? Like in Anitos Verdes?
It was a little bit of everybody. It was Maná, Caifanes, and then two albums. Because see, when you're at Tower Records, you get promos.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
I worked at the warehouse.
Right. Okay. Yeah. You know what I mean? You get promos. So a buddy of mine gave me two promos. Hey, I want you to check these guys out. All right, cool. One group was Puya. Okay. You know who's Puya?
They're heavy, right?
It's like heavy metal salsa.
Yeah, it's heavy metal salsa.
Yeah.
I always thought it was just heavy.
Yeah, that's why they're still one of my favorites, because one minute it sounds like Tito Puente, the next part of the song is Pantera. Uh-huh. You know? How they did it, I don't know, but it sounds phenomenal.
Okay.
And then the other one was Ozomatli.
Oh,
The very first album, the green one, everybody calls it. Heard both those CDs and I was hooked. I was like, okay, this is where I need to go.
What was it like the first time you saw Ozomatli live?
Oh, wow.
Because I remember it blew my fucking mind.
Saw them here in Sacramento. I think it was the Crest Theater. And I was hooked, man. Uh-huh. Just the mixture of, obviously, the Latin rhythms, the funk, and, you know, the hip hop with Charlie Tuna back then. Mm-hmm. They had the DJ, Cut Chemist. It was just everything that I grew up on, you know, all in one pretty much. And so then I became a part of a group called Raigambre in the early 2000s. Uh-huh. You know, and that's where I started to really evolve as far as like getting myself, you know, singing in Spanish and, you know, being amongst other musicians, writing music. And then, boom, I found out I was going to be a dad. And you know, and I was like, okay, I can't be in this group because I don't want to hold these guys back. So created Soul Peligro based off of I'm in charge, my way or no way, basically meaning I'm going to be a dad. So, hey, others that are probably in the same situation, join me. You know what I mean? And so it became that. And boy, I get lucky, man, with some of the guys that are in the band.
How many members were in Soul Peligro at its inception?
10.
And how many have been with you the whole ride?
Not the whole ride. Nobody's been with me since 2005.
Oh, really? It's been a revolving door.
But my drummer's been with me since 2006.
Okay, right after.
Right. So he's been with me the longest. My current guitar player joined in 07, I think.
Oh, yeah, that's a long
time. You know, and then my keyboard player joined in 06. Mm-hmm. And he's still with me. So, yeah, we're the core four pretty much as far as, like, you know, that goes, man. You know, and just like any starting band, sure, there was, like, we had our speed bumps.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so just, you know, we're trying to figure each other out first and foremost, and then trying to figure out the sound. And, and that was pretty much it. That's how it started. Been going at it since then.
When did you guys start gaining traction and start, like, getting gigs and start, like, opening up for, you know, can you tell me some of those stories?
Yeah, I think it was when we opened for Pitbull. It was over in Woodland, of all places. Uh-huh. It was I think it was a car show. I forgot what it was. But Pitbull was you know, the headliner. Uh-huh. And, you know, we opened up. A lot of people there. And you know how it is, though. Sometimes, you know, if they're there to see Pitbull.
Yeah.
And not so much anybody else. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was all right. You know, people were, digging it. But we were getting better, you know, as a unit. You know, we were starting to sound tighter. We're getting to, like, oh, yeah, man, you know, we're finally getting there. So from that point, it started to get, like, you know, we're playing concerts in the park here in Sacramento. We opened up for Ozomatli at the Fillmore. And,
really?
Yeah, and it was funny, though, because I'm not one to ever openly say anything, like, braggadocious. I'm not that type of person. Mm-hmm. But in my head, when I saw Ozomatli at the Fillmore a couple years before that, Quetzal, I don't know if you've ever heard of Quetzal.
Yeah, I've heard the name, but I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, it's a cool band from East LA. So it was Quetzal and Ozomatli over at the Fillmore. And so it was early 2000s, and I went with a couple of friends of mine. And, you know, I'm like, wow, this is awesome. And then I'm thinking in my head, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to be on that stage one day. Just watch. But I said it to myself. I'm not telling nobody that. But I'm just thinking in my head, I'm going to be up there one day. You know, somehow, some way, I'm going to be on that stage. I'm going to be opening for these guys. And sure enough, you know, I kept contacts with people over the years down in Los Angeles. And a buddy of mine, Ray Rivera, I don't know if you're related to this guy.
No.
But he's from East LA, and he used to be in a band called East LA Sabor Factory.
Okay.
Anyway, so he's very well known amongst the music scene down there. He knows Will Dog from Ozo. So I go, Ray, man, you know what? I see Ozo's playing the Fillmore, and I don't see an opener. Hook it up. Can you? And he was like, I'll try. Cool. And, you know, he was trying and trying and trying. And we didn't hear anything. But come Wednesday before the Saturday of the show, I get an email from Ozo's manager saying, call me. I think his name was Bill Sneeden. This guy was like a former manager of The Doors back in the day.
Wow.
Older guy.
That's how long he's been doing it.
Yeah. And so call me, and like called him. It was an 818 number, so I knew it was legit. You know, it was like, nobody's playing with me. Hey, what's going on? Hey, Sam, what's happening? All right, so yeah, you guys are in and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no shit. Okay, cool. And so all just the waiting and the perseverance, and told my guys, and they're like, no way. Yeah, way. And we got there. It was like.
At the Fillmore.
At the Fillmore, man.
Fuck.
Time of my life, man.
Yeah.
Time of my damn life. And then the stage manager guy gave us a little tour. And you know, it's funny what he told me. He's like, hey, you want to see something? I was like, yeah. See that right there? Yeah, it's a toilet. He's like, yeah, Jimi Hendrix took a shit there. I was just like,
yeah.
Wow, hey, well, I guess I'm going to have to too, so I can add, you know, to, you know what I mean? And it was just, because you've heard of the Fillmore.
The Fillmore's legendary.
It is. You know, everybody's played there. Everybody, we're sound checking on the stage, and I'm like,
that's fucking crazy.
You know.
Well, that's what it's like for me performing at Punchline or performing at Laughs Unlimited. Like,
right.
Just sit in that green room, and to take that stage, I'm like, I respect the fuck out of this stage.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
Like, so many people before me.
Right. And that's how I took it too, man. It just, and yeah, and that from that point on, it, you know, things got a little bit easier as far as like booking. I mean, because that's my role in the band as well. I mean, I'm not only the founder, lead singer, I'm also the manager, booking agent, promoter, everything, man. So it's just, I'm always constantly emailing people, and that's how, you know, keeping in contact with people, you know, and that's how we got the Lobos gig at Ace. Another,
yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. What was it? Okay, because anybody our age, fucking Los Lobos are, mm-hmm. like, gosh, you know, I've seen them hundreds of times, and I can remember being a freshman in high school and my brother giving me How Will the Wolf Survive.
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading about it, yep. in Rolling Stone magazine, and then my brother giving me a copy of How Will the Wolf Survive, and I remember him giving me a t-shirt. He had just seen them in LA, and I had a How Will the Wolf Survive tour shirt when I was a freshman in high school. And ultimately, though, like, fast forward, By the Light of the Moon is my favorite Los Lobos record. But
is it? Okay.
Yeah, we can
okay.
talk about that. But yeah. Tell me about what was it like, because Los Lobos had to have been on your radar. Like, it wasn't all like,
oh,
these guys.
Man.
So what was it like to get the call that you're going to open for Los Lobos?
You know, it was, again, it was kind of like, you know, like going back to with the Ozo and the Fillmore. Yes, we were excited about opening for Ozo Motley, but just like we just got done talking about the Fillmore. Wow. I was more excited about that, you know, the Fillmore than anything.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
With this, it was like, I mean, Richie Valens, La Bamba, the movie.
Yeah.
One of my all-time favorites. I mean, just, you know, I was just like, wow, this is phenomenal. And then you know how earlier I discussed we were late bloomers and the rock en español thing. Anytime I pictured Latin and rockers, it was either Los Lobos or Santana.
Yeah.
Back then. That was it. That's all I thought of. You know, Mexican dudes doing rock was just those two bands.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I didn't ever, you know, like I said, later I found out about others. But so, yeah, it was just like, I was like, no, man, no way. Really. And it was just one of those things where it was really surreal. But also, it was, these guys were so cool.
I was going to say, is it hard to be starstruck? Because didn't George Lopez bring them out on stage?
Yeah.
Yeah, so talk about that whole night. Like, you get there, you're sound checking.
Yeah.
Are they already there?
No, they were already there. So Lobos was one of the few bands that when you're the headliner, they sound check, and then they, most headliners, they split. You know, they go to their hotels. Because if you're an opener, you're the one that's always sound checking last, because
your equipment's
you might as well just stay right there, your levels, you know, with the sound guy. Boom. And so one guy went back to the hotel. But David Hidalgo, Steve Berlin, and then I think it's the bass player. No, Cesar's the one that went to the hotel.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So he's too cool, man, you know. He's a cool guy, though, but yeah, he had to go to the hotel. But it was Cesar, it was Conrad, and it was David Hidalgo. Wow. Stuck around. They stuck around for our set. And I was really, like, I was nervous.
So you're taking the stage. You know that they're watching.
Right, right. Okay. Because at Ace of Spades, you know, there's the stage right here. And then to the left of us is the door where you come in from, you know, the backstage, the green room, and whatever. So the door's open. And then, you know, David Hidalgo, he's not a short guy.
Yeah.
You know, he's pretty tall. And so, you know, we're, you know, getting ready to start. And I kind of look at the corner of my eye, and I see his silhouette just standing right there. I was like, Jesus Christ, what the heck? So I looked at everybody. We got to kill it, man.
Fuck yeah.
You know what I mean? Because literally it's like I don't get nervous much, but I can honestly say at that moment I was really nervous. Not, you know, not opening for Los Lobos, because there can be 1,000 people in front of us and we're gonna rock it. You know, we're not worried about the crowd.
You're not worried about doing your job.
Right.
You know how to do your job.
Right, exactly. But knowing that one of the members of the bands that I have admired for so many years is standing there watching, checking us out. I'm like, wow, okay.
Was there a point during the set that you were able to look over and you could tell that he was enjoying it?
Yeah. Yeah. No. You know, because you know how the thing is, he's just, you know, bobbing the head a little bit, kind of thing. And then, you know, and I was like, holy shit. I mean, I was just so blown away by all that. And what was cool about that, though, and you know how normally everything's fine, you know, go backstage after, hang out. We took pictures and whatever. So Steve, hey, give me a call sometime.
Berlin, the sax player.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah, give me a call sometime. I was like, oh, okay, cool. No, because he's like, you got some good shit. I'm like, wow, okay. And then he's featuring on one of our songs.
Yeah.
So, you know, the song Paraíso, he's the one that does the Barry solo on there.
Wow.
And so it was cool because when Los Lobos was doing a show at the Memorial Auditorium with Tedeschi Trucks Band.
Oh, shit.
They were doing a tour with them. And so Steve was like, I've got time earlier in the day, blah, blah, blah. If you want me to come through and lay down that solo, I'll do it. I'm like, cool.
Wow.
And so set it up. He, you know, got his rent a car, came through the studio and laid it down. And yeah, man, it's...
I saw Susan Tedeschi open up for the Allman Brothers when Trux was the guitarist, right? When Trux that's fucking dope.
Yeah, man, and Steve Berlin is the type, and I've heard a lot about him. He's not just gonna do things just as a favor.
Mm-hmm.
He's really gotta like what he's doing with you, mm-hmm. you know. He'll tell you if something sucks.
Yeah,
and he's told me that. Because I've sent him like 3 or 4 tracks, but just send me whatever. He's like, Sam, I'm not feeling that one. I'm liking this one. This one over here, maybe we could work on the arrangement, you know, giving me the honest feedback.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, he'll say when he's not feeling it, and you know, that's pretty much it. So that's when, you know, somebody in the industry told me, yeah, you got Steve Berlin to come out and record something with you. That's a lot, because that means he likes you.
Yeah,
you know, and that he likes your guys' stuff.
Step on just anything.
Right, exactly. He's not just gonna, oh, you're paying me this money, sure, I'll do it on, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so yeah, we were really fortunate and grateful for that, man. And he's just a cool guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And and then another time where I thought, I was like, holy moly, where am I at? We played Dodger Stadium.
What the fuck? How did that happen?
It was on the
Viva. Like the Cinco de Mayo Day?
It was the Viva Los Dodgers Sundays.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know how they had those on Sundays in the summers? And I think it was 2016. Yeah. And so my buddy Ray Rivera hooked that up. And he's like, you want to play Dodger Stadium? Fucking damn right I do, because I'm a Dodger fan.
Yeah.
And so I'm just like, hell yeah. And they paid us and... hung out in LA for the weekend, and it was great, man.
How'd you end up being a Dodger fan?
Well, I told you I was born in L.A.
Oh, yeah, but you moved like at 2 years old.
Well, the thing is that, you know how as Mexicans during Christmas break, we always went back.
Oh, okay.
Okay, went back to L.A. on the way to Mexico.
Yeah.
You know, those 30-hour drives or whatever. So, yeah. And so that's, you know, a lot of my cousins, you know, on my my dad's side, which is in Los Angeles, they were all Dodger fans, of course, and that was big, you know, and then especially when Fernando came through, Fernando Mania. And so, yeah, it is funny, but it's exciting to me being a Dodger fan in Giants country because I love it.
I'm a Dodger fan, and you know one of my favorite things to do is like to wear a Dodger hat and wear a Dodger hat and a 49er sweater, or like a Dodger hat and a King sweater. Like the looks I get are just like
man, and you know I just enjoy it. I mean I'm not a big super duper fan guy like I used to be because people get too crazy, man.
Yeah,
they get out of hand. And I mean, I'm still going to root for my teams, but I'm not going to get all like, you know what I mean? And, you know, you see like on the reels on Instagram, all the fights that happen, you know what I mean? And I'm just like, nah, man, I just want to enjoy my team, you know, and that's it.
Right on. So Salt Peligro has been together that long.
Yeah.
And then when did the side projects spawn off of the Peligro Brass? Is that something that like you'd been wanting to do, and other guys just were busy doing stuff? So
no,
like, let me jump in on this or what? How did that come about?
It happened because of COVID.
Oh, that was gonna be my second guess.
That's it. There's no real good story behind that. Just
was everyone just emailing tracks or what?
It was, you know what it was, man. And, you know, because like I mentioned before, with Soul, I do all the managing, so constantly emailing and stuff, right? So when the pandemic hit, everything was shut down, you know, everybody's like, you know, not wanting to go out, not wanting to do, I mean, and I meant everything. So I couldn't email event organizers, festival organizers, promoters, venues, because they were all shut down. And so for the first time in my musical life, I was like, what do I do? I am bored. Sure, I can write a song, but I can only do that so much. I'll get bored. And because we rehearse at my guitar player's house, we weren't going to get together and then compromise him and his wife's, you know, comfort zone. We're like, okay, we're not going to get together. So it was like a good 2 to 3 months of not doing anything, you know? And so then I got together with this one guy who was a videographer. And we were initially, we have a song called Agüita de Melón that we wrote. And we were initially supposed to shoot an actual music video. But the pandemic hit. Then we thought, hey, you know what? You know that Pharrell music video, Happy, where he's got a bunch of people just dancing like they're happy and stuff? And so we thought, let's see if people wouldn't mind submitting videos of themselves just doing what they're doing and shelter in place. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, man, we got a bunch of submissions because everybody else is just as bored as we are. You know, so people dancing to the song. I emailed the song to the people that were submitting the videos. People would submit it. You know, there was one girl, you know, she's like a belly dancer. She's doing all her stuff. And then kids dancing, families dancing. And so we put that all together like a collage. And boom, you know, it was something.
Who's editing these videos?
At the time, it's a buddy of mine, Andrew Gaynor. He's also the one that shot the music video for Misunderstood.
Yep, we watched that this morning.
Okay. So when we were doing the Agüita de Melón edits, I'm sitting there next to him, and there's this big old tuba. And so I asked him, hey, who plays that? And he's, oh, yeah, Jared, you know, whatever, you know. And I'm like, And I just had this idea. Because, again, I'm bored. Uh-huh. And so my trombone player, he was still with me. I was like, hey, tell Jared, you know, let's probably get together somewhere, just us three. I want to see what this sound, what's going to sound like. So initially, it was just supposed to be just one song that we were just going to do, you know, for shits and giggles.
Yeah.
You know, I was going to record it on my phone, post it, but we started rehearsing, and I was like, whoa, wait a minute. Boom, 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 boom. And then we were messing with Misunderstood, and I was like, hey, no, let's play it cumbia style. Dun, 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 you know what I mean? And hey, let's call some other horns. And then boom, there we are.
Wow.
And that was it. And because Soa Peligro, we weren't doing anything at all. I was like, you know what? Let's ride the wave with this, man. And, you know, and because we had so much time, you know, we recorded it, mastered it, scheduled a video recording date up in Locke over off the Delta. Mm-hmm. It's a real cool little town. I'm not sure if you've ever been there. It looks really kind of like New Orleans-ish, you know.
I was trying to figure out where it was.
Yeah. It's a little town off the Delta, and did it in black and white. We had fun.
Yeah.
Released it, and then before you know it, man, it just caught on mm-hmm. with people down, especially down in L.A. with a lot of the cholos, you know, and the low riders.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that song, that's big in the Chicano community. You know what I mean? But then how we did it, cumbia style with horns, and then they saw the music video, they're like, what the hell? You know, and it just caught on, and we just stuck with it for a little while. Then, of course, you know, everything lifted and lost a couple of members because of scheduling. They went back to, you know, being in their schedules, and everybody was busy.
Right.
So that's how we were able to do it, because nobody was busy. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So
it was like a pandemic side project.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Man, you got something great out of it.
We did. And we're still going to keep doing it recording wise. But as far as shows, probably not.
So when Sol Peligro plays, is Misunderstood part of the set list?
Not yet.
Are you going to sneak it in?
I will. I'm going to, man. Uh-huh. Because there's just a lot of support for that. Namely, there's this woman down in Los Angeles who she plays on Instagram. She calls herself Soul Sundays. She really loved the song, and she hit me up. Hey, can I get a copy of that? Yeah, sure. And sent her a copy of the 45 vinyl. Mm-hmm. And you know, she played it on her show and all this kind of stuff. And then turns out she's Mr. Cartoon's wife.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
so for those who don't know, Mr. Cartoon, tattoo artist.
Famous tattoo artist, graph artist, Soul Assassins. Yeah.
He's like almost like the fourth member of Cypress Hills.
Pretty much.
Yeah, right? Because he's on stage. Like, I think if you watch like the Cypress Hills at Woodstock, he's on stage like mm-hmm. taking pictures and just like, yeah.
Yeah, it's him. And then the photographer is Stavon Oriol. Uh-huh. Yeah, they were a part. Just it's the whole Soul Assassins family.
Yep.
And so anyway, I didn't know.
I was thinking of the photographer.
You know, and she, yeah. The photographer is Estevan. Yeah, exactly.
The photographer is like the fourth member, but Cartoon was with them. Like,
well, yeah, he was the one that designed their albums up until a certain point where he stopped because he got too busy. Mm-hmm. He was designing, I think, their fourth album, I think Temples of Boom. Yeah, man. And so, and then we released another single. It's more of an oldies tune. It's called Why, mm-hmm. but it's not the full brass. It's just a couple of us on the song, but uh-huh. it's produced by Chris Luan, and it's got the oldies feel. And again, the Peligro Brass following loved it. And then she loved it. And this is what's cool, man, is like I sent her a copy of that. He ended up playing it on his Instagram. Cartoon. Yeah, Cartoon did. And tagged us. And then when he tagged us, we get like...
How many?
The followers just exploded.
Wow.
I was just like, whoa. And what's even cool about all of that, they weren't asking for anything. They just were... They're true fans.
Yeah.
They just truly love the music.
Cats like that, they know what these grassroots movements are like,
and
to show love to somebody that's doing it
mm-hmm.
and came up the same way they came up, the same types of neighborhoods and the same types of influences. Like, we love to support each other,
right? Exactly. You know, and you know, because you know, there are some cats out there that hey, let me send you a shirt, and I charge, you know, for me to wear your shirt. You know, and it's like, oh, come on. But no, these guys, you know, Cartoon and his wife are just like, no, we love this. Thanks for, you know, adding it to our collection. And they say that as much on their Instagrams. Hey, these are the boys, Peligro Brass, another hit, whatever. And it's like, whew, yeah, man.
Wow.
So grateful that, you know, Soul is doing well. And you know, I got lucky with Brass. And, you know, we're going to keep, you know, recording. You know, right now we're doing some recordings with Soul. And so, yeah, new stuff, new music, man. And going to keep on trucking.
What was it? Was playing Ace of Spades as spectacular for you growing up in Sacramento as playing the Fillmore? Or what about, like, the Crest?
We played the Crest.
Yeah. Is it the same type of feeling or not the Fillmore?
Man, you know, I'm grateful, and I have enjoyed every stage I've played.
Okay.
Even old Ironsides, because every stage or every venue has their certain vibe of that night. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But to really answer your question, Fillmore is tops, man. And I don't know, unless we get to New York, you know what I mean? Apollo or somebody like that.
Apollo?
You know, that would probably come close to that. But yeah, Fillmore. Well, you know, Fillmore, because I've been California, so I'm more familiar with that than anything, though. But yeah, man, if we're in New York and if the Apollo is ever on, yeah, oh, heck yeah. Because that's just got as much history as anything else, you know?
Yeah, I stood inside the Apollo. Like, we were taking a hip-hop tour.
Oh, nice, nice.
And I had to use the bathroom. And
Okay.
Yeah, and they let me go inside and use the bathroom. And
nice.
I snuck
it. Now, that would have been cool if somebody would have told you, hey, Marvin Gaye took a shit here. You know?
Everyone.
Yeah. Oh, that would have been awesome. Yeah. That would have been awesome.
Yeah, it's been like Lauryn Hill shit here the night she got booed off stage.
Oh, know? Man. You know, that's why she was late, you know?
Yeah, that's why she was late. Oh, man.
That's awesome, man.
This is great. So, you love Sacramento? Do you love it here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, no.
You never thought about moving anywhere else? This is it?
The only time I've ever thought about it, though, is because, and if I ever do, is because it's just, it's becoming non-affordable sometimes, you know? Mm. You feel that, you know what I mean? And it's like, you know, it's, you know, California in general,
yeah.
You know? It's becoming where, man, you can't afford, you know, the cost of living.
I really like Woodland.
You know? You know, Woodland has...
Has Woodland called you back?
Oh, they all, what do you mean, like to?
Do you think to live back there?
Nah,
no,
nah, no. Nah. I mean, no, they haven't. But I mean, I wouldn't. I'm not saying no, but I'm so immersed in here now. You know what I mean? In Sacramento, where, you know, when I thought about this one time, years wise, I've already lived longer in Sacramento than I ever did in Woodland.
Okay.
You know, so technically, yeah, and I'm a Sacramentan, but no, deep down, I mean, Woodland is my hometown. Mm-hmm. You know, when I go back, yeah, memories and seeing old friends. And but when I was there, when I was growing up, it was a lot smaller than what it is now, man. Yeah. It's expanded everywhere.
You could tell, like, it's still expanding. It's mm-hmm. it's a growing town. I mean, they have like two Dutch brothers. They have like more than one.
Well, yeah, you know. And back when I was growing up, there was, you know, one Winchell's Donuts in town. And that's where you got your coffee, too, you know. And so, no, it's a great little town. And you know what, though, man? A lot of the times... Well, I don't know. Would Bakersfield be considered a small town?
To me, it's a small town, but it's growing and it's growing. And it's growing.
Okay.
It's a big small town.
Right. So you can probably relate to this, though, where anytime any small town always has their elements. Because, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes people are just like, man, I got to get out of here. Because people get weighed down, whether they're, you know, addicts of some sort or just they're stuck in a rut or whatever. The way I've always, you know, I mean, everybody always has their thinkings or their beliefs about small towns. I mean, to me, man, you make what you make of it. Whether you're in a small town, big town, doesn't matter. Or, you know, you live in a trailer home, it doesn't matter. Your home is what you make it, you know? And sometimes, oh, I can't go back to that town. It, you know, I get caught up and there's no, yeah, you get caught up. Nobody sucks you in, uh-huh. you know? They like, oh, I can't hang out with these certain crowds no more because of, well, then don't.
Right, right.
You know? And so I just, you know, Woodland is a great little town.
It is.
You know, exactly. It is a great little town.
Yeah. And I drive Lyft part-time, and I do not mind when I get pulled out to Woodland. It's always the nicest people.
Yeah.
And it's always easy to find.
Yeah, you know, sometimes, you know, some of the folks that I'm still in contact with that live there, oh, you don't want to go out here past 10 or midnight. I was like, well, you don't want to go out past 10 midnight over here either.
Yeah, that's anywhere. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, everybody's always getting stabbed. I was like, well, it happens over here. Happens everywhere. And a lot of the times a small town vibe gets that bad rap.
Right.
You know, because not everything can be Andy Griffith's show, Mayberry, and, you know, it's not always like that. You're just, you know, walking down with the fishing pole to the local creek and, you know, whistling Dixie. But no, man, it's a... Yeah, I love that little town.
Nice,
definitely.
Nice. We're turning the corner and we're starting to come home.
Okay.
Like on the podcast, and I like to wrap up the podcast with with the segment I call 5 Easy Questions.
Ooh, okay.
And I don't think I sent them to you because they're easy, but
no, but I don't. Yeah, I never, because I think I told you, I was like, if you're gonna do that, I don't want to know. I like to do off the top of the head stuff. So,
question number one: who or what inspires you? And this could be about life, music, just whatever, like. Who or what inspires you?
Whoa. Well, just in life in general, you know, I got to say my son.
I thought you were going to say that.
I got to say my son because he's 18 now. And I look at him and, you know, I'm proud of what he's become. You know what I mean? And it's just like every kid goes through things. We all go through things. And he went through something minor, but got through it. And now he's just great, man. You know what I mean? So just looking at him and how, you know, the trajectory of what he's doing now, you know, he's a young man now. He's no longer, I still call him my kid, but you know what I mean? But it's just, you know, he's still my mijo. He always will be. But yeah, man, I look at him and I'm just like, yeah, you know what?
That's dope.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
You're very proud of his accomplishments.
Oh yeah. Definitely. Most definitely. Okay.
And this next question, it doesn't necessarily have to be TV shows or books or like just what are you currently binging? Like, what's something that you just cannot get enough of right now? We're rewatching Reservation Dogs right now.
Oh, God. I have yet to see that. I got to watch that.
You got to watch it. What are you currently binging?
Nothing new, but check this out. I've got Netflix, of course. So what I'm currently doing right now on YouTube, every so often, they'll throw up movies for free. Okay. I don't know if you guys would see that sometimes, right? And so the other day I was rewatching Beverly Hills Cop.
Oh,
The first one, the very first one. One of my favorite all time, one of my favorites. Yeah. And so it came up. I was like, what? Oh, yeah, I got to watch this again. Because it had been years since I watched it.
That's a great soundtrack.
You know, yeah, I got that one.
Okay.
Yes, yes. So I hadn't seen that in a movie. I mean, I hadn't seen that in years. And, you know, and then I saw on the side, because, you know, like when you're watching it and then on the side, it'll show you other movies you can watch for free. Mm-hmm. So there's other ones that I'm going to tackle, like probably some of the stupidest movies ever made, but I enjoy it. There's that one, it's called Vice Versa with Judge Reinhold and the dude from The Wonder Years.
Yeah.
Okay. And then
Fred
Savage. And then there's another one that's exactly like that, but with Dudley Moore and Kirk Cameron.
Like father, like son?
There we go. That one.
Oh, my gosh.
So those are free right now. So I'm going to get to watching those because I haven't seen those in years.
Yeah.
So if you want to say what I'm binging right now, I'm binging old movies.
You know what? You know what's not on Netflix and is one of like the biggest movies of young Jesse's life? Eddie and the Cruisers.
Oh. You know what? Unless you buy it for rental.
I have it on DVD.
Okay.
You can't even rent it.
You can't?
No.
Wow.
Yeah. Do you remember that movie?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, and you know what other movie that I just saw? Crossroads. Remember that with Ralph Macchio?
And Steve Vai?
Steve Vai. Steve Vai. Jamie Gertz. Yeah. Oh, that was another one that was for free.
Yeah.
And I was just like, man, I remember these movies. You know, watching them in VHS, you know? And And that's what I mean, though. It's like there's a lot of those movies that weren't as popular.
You're watching all these old movies.
I'm rewatching them. I'm re-binging all of these movies, man.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Question number three, kind of a serious question.
Okay.
What are you afraid of?
At first, if you were to ask me this like 5-6 years ago, I would say I'm afraid of not providing for my kid. Okay. But that's already done now. He's got a job now. He's, you know, he's fine. So I think the next thing, what I'm afraid of, man, not being able to, because there's going to be a time where I'm not going to be able to sing like I can.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Because the voice eventually, you know, takes its course, you know? You're not going to be able to sing those certain notes anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, yeah, as a singer, that's what I'm afraid of. I'm not sure when it's going to happen. I try to take care of it as much as possible.
Yeah.
But what's cool about it, though, is like I was when it came to like actually singing, I was a late bloomer. I didn't start really singing until late 90s,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so, whereas like a lot of people, man, they started singing and, you know, hardcore and most of their life. So I've got a good 10, 15 more years, I think.
That's a long time.
Give or take. You know, but yeah, that's the one thing, because once that's gone, then okay, I'm gonna become somebody's road manager or something. I don't know, but but yeah, that's what I'm afraid of right now, man.
All right, number four, this is kind of a fun question. You're on death row, what's your last meal?
Chicken enchiladas.
From?
Ooh. Homemade from somebody's mama, I hope. not from a restaurant, but yeah, I'm hoping, you know, one of my elder tías or somebody out there that's going to listen to this. Hey, not that I'll be on death row sometime soon, but no. You know, but yeah, hopefully. Chicken enchiladas, man.
Right on. And the last question, man, the theme of the podcast, what's next for you? What's next for San Marino? What's next for Soul Peligro? What's next?
Wow. Yeah. Well, you know, like I mentioned before, where Soul Peligro is working on new music. We have a show coming up at Harlow's February 9th.
Okay.
We're playing with a group out of the Bay Area called Disco Resaca, Mariposas del Alma. And they did a cumbia version of Love for All Seasons or something like that.
Okay.
So, you know, I love you for so many reasons. Yeah.
Okay.
So they did a cumbia version of that, and that took off. So we're planning on that. And also, I think in May, I've got to get the date right. In May, we'll be playing in Woodland.
Nice.
Over at the Hive.
Nice.
Yeah, so looking forward to that. And then just releasing music, man. Just releasing more music. And just that's the one thing that I enjoy doing is writing my own stuff.
Yeah.
You know, just, you know, getting, you know, being creative. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And just like, and then, like, you know, it's hard to be, you know, to stand out, I guess, you know, and I guess I can't, you know, there's always been a question I wanted to ask, man. Let me ask you, you're a comedian.
Yeah.
What is it? Because I like to consider myself a funny guy, quote unquote, you know what I mean? Just like pushy, you know what I mean? Oh, you really are a funny guy, you know, amongst family and friends. I am just a household funny guy. How is it that you guys as comedians can just stand up there alone for the 3-5 minutes that you guys have? I've always been infatuated with that. What is it? How do you do it?
You know what I heard somebody say it once is the there, like, growing up, there was class clowns. There was always a class clown,
right?
The class clown is the class clown. The comic was the person urging the class clown to say this, do this, right?
So always, okay,
like, we've seen that spotlight.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I like holding court. Like, to me, it's always been like, I've enjoyed holding court. Like,
okay,
if there's two or three people, I want you guys listening to me,
right?
If there's five people, I want you guys listening to me. Like, so it, and it was always just like, I don't know, like, I have a story to tell. I want to tell my story. And I think it's also, well, like, the whole comedy thing, because it's all, it, I think all, I will say all comics, they were, the comic side of them was born in a dark place.
Okay.
And to me, when I was a kid, if I was making you laugh, then you weren't going to ask me about my life. If I could keep you entertained, then you weren't going to ask me about the stuff that I didn't want to talk about.
Okay.
So the more I could keep you entertained, the more I could control the conversation.
The more you're distracting somebody from wanting to ask more in-depth questions
and then,
or whatever. Okay.
But then also, like, the once, okay, so like I am a recovered meth addict.
Okay.
Right? So I can remember what that first night of meth was like. I can remember what that first hit of coke was like.
Okay.
I can remember what that first hit of crack was like, right? The first time that I stood on stage and it wasn't even on stage, it was in a classroom, that I told a joke that I wrote and received laughter back.
Right.
That's the dragon I've been chasing ever since.
Like, nice. Okay.
That laughter. The first time that I stood on one end of the stage and told a joke and then walked towards the other end of the stage and the laughter followed me like a wave.
Yeah.
That's my addiction now. So I don't know if that right answered on. Your question in any way.
No, because again, it's everybody has their own focus, I guess, you know what I mean? Because, you know, when I think back to, like, the old comedians like Robin Williams, Sam Kinison, Farley, you know what I mean?
Dark stuff. Yeah,
right, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. They all had
these demons,
something, and so it's you know, again, I've always, like, thought, like, how, what is it that drives them, like, you know what I mean? And now that you've explained that, it's like, you know, you look for something to kind of you know, interject it like that,
when,
you know?
When you're on stage and there's one person or 1,000 people, how many do you see? I only see the first two tables. That's all I see, is like this first two tables They're laughing.
Yeah.
This show is for them. And I could hear the rest of it, right? Sometimes it's 300 people. Sometimes it's 10 people.
Mm-hmm.
I only see these first two tables. What do you see when you're on stage?
The lights above.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That's all I focus on, man. Mm-hmm. Because, again, I don't, and I've been doing that all this time. Any show that I've done, I'm always looking at the lights above. And if it's a festival or something like that during the day, I'm looking at whatever's in the sky. And if there's a tree there or whatever, because one time I saw somebody in the crowd. This person was not moving for nothing.
Oh, shit.
Everybody around this girl was moving, but she was just kind of like as if she wasn't enjoying us, right? And so I was just like, oh man, I didn't want to look at that. You know. I mean, I didn't let it affect me though, but I'm just like, oh, see, that's not what I wanted to, you know, because that her face just stayed in my mind the rest of the set.
Yeah.
You know, because she was just, you know, you could tell she wasn't feeling us. And it's like, all right, but that was just one person. Everybody else was just dancing circles around her though, you know. But yeah, you know, I focus on other things, man. You know, because again, though, I don't know. I might forget a word if I do otherwise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, man. Do we talk about everything you want to talk about? Do we leave it?
Yeah, we could.
We could go for hours.
We could do a series or something like that, man. And, but yeah, no, man. You know, thanks for having me, man.
Thanks for always.
This is a cool platform, man. Yeah. I like this. I like this, man. Definitely.
All right, man. It was good having you on.
Thank you very much, brother. All right, brother. Thanks, man.
Look, I think she knows it's over. She's like.
Like, oh, right, I get to talk to Sam now.
Oh, man, that was fun, man.